as a beautiful, bright-eyed young secretary at NAV headquarters. It wasn't long before Rod Sargent, the most eligible bachelor in the Navigators, fell in love with her, and they were married in 1967. Over the years, God has used Rod and Diane in many, many lives. And in the last 7 years, God, for his own special reasons, chose to do a very deep work in their lives through Rod's continual battle with cancer. And as the rest of us have observed, their trust in him and their allowing God to work in them and through them. And Rod's home going in February, we have been taught, we have been challenged, we have been deeply touched and moved by the Spirit of God. And Diane, we want you to know that God has used you and is continuing to use you. And we know that the things that you share with us today are going to come from the Spirit of God and that he will minister to us through you. Thanks for coming to be with us.
Thank you, Buzzy. First of all, I'd like to do a little introduction. My sister Ginny Schultz is here with me today, and they have just moved here to Colorado Springs. So it's really fun to have a little family in town. Well, it is also thanks to Joyce Turner that I'm here today, because I was coming yesterday until I talked to her. This past June, I was asked to give a workshop entitled Living Through the Hard Times. And as I prepared for it, I realized that I couldn't talk about living through the hard times. I needed to change the through to in. Living in the hard times, and I'd like to explain to you why. For most of us, there are hard times to one degree or another. For some of us, they're few and far between. But for the vast majority, their life is a struggle and becomes more so at one time or another. There was a time in my life when life seemed too easy. There wasn't much happening, good or bad. Then, as Buzzy said, in November of 1979, after spending 3 hours in the waiting room, the doctor came out and said that Rod had cancer and that the outlook wasn't good. Rod spent a year on chemotherapy, and then in the fall of 1980, our son entered junior high and began a very hard time for him and for all of us in the family. He struggled in ways that deeply affected each of us. And then in December of that year, Rod had cancer surgery again. By the end of February 1981, after Rod had recovered from the surgery, when they were going to put him back on chemotherapy, his blood pressure skyrocketed so that they feared a stroke. So back in the hospital, he went again. In 1983, our daughter entered junior high, and again, real struggles for us and for her, again affecting all of the family. Then in December of 1985, Rod's leg began to swell. This was after being clear of cancer for 5 years. Tests were run, cancer was discovered, and he had surgery in January of 86. The difference this time was that the doctor couldn't remove it all. There was still cancer in his abdomen and cancer in his groin. So Rod spent a year on chemotherapy and radiation and in pain every single day. As Buzzy said, on February 8th of this year, Rod went home to be with the Lord. That was 7 months ago on Tuesday. End of the story? End of hard times? No. Those songs did it to me. I'm not sure how well we're going to do today. Now I am a widow learning to live without Rod. And most difficultly, watching my children. Well, I'll skip that. From the time of Rod's first surgery in 79 until his death was a little over 7 years. And 7 years is just too long a time to learn to live through, to always be waiting until it's over, to be gritting your teeth, to hold on until the end. And this is one of the richest lessons that I learned. We need not to learn to live through the hard times as though there's something disagreeable, as though they're a sublife, a divergent from normal life, a thing or situation or period to be endured until it's over, until real life can begin again. Excuse me, we need to learn to live, really live, in the hard times. This was a mindset I consciously practiced, especially last year, as we lived knowing that unless God chose to heal Rod, he would eventually die from the cancer this time. This was also what I learned to accept when only one member of our family was struggling, but making the rest of the family miserable. That this was life, real life, and we had to learn to live in it as such. Life consists of happy and sad times, of hard and easy times. One is not normal and the other abnormal. And the good, the happy, the easy is not better or more desirable than the sad, the hard, or even the painful. Let's think for a minute about hard times. What are hard times for you? What makes you struggle? Some of Paul's hard times are listed in 2 Corinthians 11, 23 through 29. And I want to read them to you. I have worked much harder, been in prison more frequently, been flogged more severely, and been exposed to death again and again. 5 times I received from the Jews the 40 lashes minus one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. 1 I was stoned. 3 I was shipwrecked. I spent a night and a day in the open sea. I have been constantly on the move. I have been in danger from rivers, in danger from bandits, in danger from my own countrymen, in danger from Gentiles, in danger in the city, in danger in the country, in danger at sea, and in danger from false brothers. I have labored and toiled and often gone without sleep. I have known hunger and thirst and have often gone without food. I have been cold and naked. Most of us haven't experienced one of these happenings, much less all of them. Job was a godly man from whom was taken all of his possessions and relationships except a nagging wife and questionable friends. Everything and practically everyone he loved was destroyed. What are your hard times? Why are they hard? Actually, why they're hard can be what makes them so unbearable. When the hard is understood, at least for me, then we can really begin to live in them instead of enduring them. So it helps sometimes to understand why they're hard. Sometimes it's because we haven't learned to be content. And I'd like to read again what Paul said, which most of you know, from Philippians 4. 4:11 and 12. I am not saying this because I've learned because I am in need, for I have learned to be content, whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or want. Why does your nose run when your eyes cry? Here Paul tells us he's learned to be content in plenty and want. He was talking about finances and food. But we also need to consider our contentment level when we're in want relationally, physically, mentally, and what about plenty and want emotionally? As I said, I am in want emotionally. My husband of 20 years is gone. And it's been awesome for me to see just what Rod had become to me over the years. And so many things I wasn't really aware of until he was gone. The first area I felt the loss was as my confidant. Even as he was dying, I longed to talk to him about it, to find out what he felt. And when he died, I so much wanted to know what he was experiencing right then. And at the funeral, to know if he was pleased. Did he feel it honored the Lord? Was it what he would have wanted? Was he even aware of it? Now, no matter who I tell something to, I no longer feel the release of sharing. Because when I had told him something, it had been shared. The next area I really missed him in was in belonging, being a part of a whole. Now I just feel like I'm a part. Almost everything I did was affected in some way by him. We shared our children. We shared our drawers. We shared our closet. We shared our dreams, our activities, etc. I am in want emotionally, and I don't deny that. But God has allowed it, and he will use it for good. Therefore, I accept it from his loving, wise hand as his best for me today. And as Paul says, I am content, even in my pain and want. Another reason why things are hard sometimes is because we're not realistic. There is no life without trouble. Our experience is not unusual. Many families experience difficulties when they're raising children. Lots of you have experienced health problems, relationship problems, and everybody dies at one time or another. So none of us are unique in what we're experiencing. Are you a person who is more down than you are up? Could it be that your expectations are unrealistic? Job's friend Eliphaz is the one who said, "Man is born to trouble as surely as sparks fly upward," in Job 5:7. And this wasn't said in a tone of doom and gloom, but of realistically facing life. This is the way life is, so we're not surprised by it or cast down by it. Ever since sin entered the world, things have not gone right the way God intended for them to. Our bodies don't function perfectly. They get sick and diseased. They get broken. They get hurt, and they die. God didn't intend that. Our emotions are weak, troubled, and assaulted constantly. God didn't intend that. Our relationships are constantly in turmoil. God didn't intend that. Sin has so pervaded our lives that no area is free from its effects. Christ has saved us from the penalty of sin and broken the power of mindless obedience to it, but every area of life is still deeply affected by it. So we expect it, we accept it, and then we trust God in his wisdom and power to use it for good, not necessarily to rid us of it, but much more importantly, to use it for good in every single life that's affected by it. Everybody has trouble of one sort or another, as I've said, and everybody dies. So to waste time and emotion to sin and arrogance and pride demanding to know why is really quite ridiculous. These things happen to everyone. And these are just a couple of reasons why sometimes situations in life are so hard for us. How do I react to these hard things? Second area I'd like for us to consider is defeating or cooperating with God. Romans 8:28 in the NIV is very clear, clear translation of it, where he says, "For we know that in all things God works for good for those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose." In all things God works for our good. Does how we act and react in these things affect how much good he can do? Does God do it to us? Does God do good for us in spite of us? Can he work for good when we don't cooperate? Does he overrule our will? Or does how we react to hard things affect how much good he can do? Can we truly defeat God in our lives as he works for good? Will he force his good upon us? The first area I think we can defeat God in is by reacting in self-pity. How can God teach a recalcitrant person compared to a cooperative learner? How much can he teach a humble person compared to an arrogant one? How does God see us in hard times? How do we approach him in hard times? Are we recalcitrant, rebellious, uncooperative? I looked up recalcitrant just to make sure I was using it right. And it's perfect for what we were talking about. Webster says it's to refuse to obey authority, custom, regulation, to be stubbornly defiant, to be hard to handle or to deal with. Probably most of us would say, no, we're not like that, at least not outwardly. But inwardly, how do we react in the hard times? Are we fighting it, doing everything within our power to get it over with, holding our breath until the end of it? Or are we running away from it? Or perhaps even worse, are we arrogant and self-pitying? The arrogance is subtle. It's usually expressed by, why me? And what are we saying when we say that? We're saying, I'm too good for this to happen to. Or at least I'm not so bad. Or what have I done to deserve it? Rather, should we not ask, why not me? Especially in light of all the good, kind, godly people that horrendous things have happened to over the years. Look at Paul. Look at Job. What did they do to deserve what happened to them? Paul walked with God. He gave his life in service to God. He wrote a major portion of the New Testament. He gave up a family and a home life in order to travel in missionary service. Did God protect him? We've already read all the horrible things that happened to him in his lifetime. What about Job? Listen to how God described him to Satan. There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. Then after saying this, God allowed everything to happen to him except his own death. But as we look to see their reaction to their problems, there's a great difference. In Philippians 3:7-12, we hear Paul's reaction to the hardships of his life. But whatever was to my profit, I now consider loss for the sake of Christ. What is more, I consider everything a loss compared to the surpassing greatness of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord, for whose sake I have lost all things. I consider them rubbish that I may gain Christ and be found in him, not having a righteousness of my own that comes from the law, but that which is through faith in Christ the righteous that comes from God and is by faith. I want to know Christ and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of sharing in his sufferings, becoming like him in his death. What we have just heard is a solid, deep commitment to knowing God and to knowing Christ above everything else. Nothing else in his life compared in importance. Then there's Job. With Job, we see self-pitying. Job started unbelievably well. His response when his children, all his children were killed, was, "The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." After his personal afflictions, he said, "Shall we accept good from God and not trouble?" But as the misery continued, his heart is revealed. Self-pity and self-righteousness are abundant and a very inaccurate concept of God. As I studied the life of Job, I noticed that the longer God was silent, the more sin was revealed in Job's life. It made me realize why sometimes God lets a situation go on and on. Until we know what we really believe, God can't purify our faith. All the impurities begin to come to the surface when the situation is more than we can bear, when we no longer care what anyone else thinks. Then we really begin to find out what's in our heart. The situation didn't improve until God began to speak to Job. And not after he'd brought Job out of it, but when Job was at the very bottom of it. And Job began to listen. All of Job's great boastings of bringing his case before God, showing God how wrong he was, etc., died when he was actually confronted with the living God. I never forgotten something Rod said to me not too long after we were married. He was going on an overseas trip, and I had been invited to go with him. And he asked me if I wanted to go, and I said, "Well, no," I said, "I didn't think I deserved to go." And I said, "There are so many wives whose husbands travel a lot and have been gone a lot, and they deserve a trip like that, and I don't think I should have one." And he just said to me, "The question is not, do you deserve it? If we got what we deserved, it would be hell and nothing else. Life is not based on what we deserve to be given to us or to be done to us." Another area of cooperating with God is trusting him in the hard times. The question is not, why me? But the scriptures do give us a lot of answers just to the question, why? Let's look at what Paul said in 2 Corinthians 1:9. He said, "Indeed, in our hearts we felt the sentence of death. But these things happened so that we might not rely on ourselves, but on God who raises the dead." These things happened so that. I think that's incredible. We just read what happened. Beatings, floggings, shipwreck, hunger, imprisonment. All so that Paul might learn to rely on God. It must be a very hard lesson to learn. It must take a long time to learn it. But most importantly, it must be of incredible significance that we learn it. We talk a lot about trusting God, but I don't think we know how important it really is, because of the price that sometimes is paid for it. Look at the price Job paid. His cattle, sheep, servants, then all, not just one, but all his children were taken from him. The book of Job is the study of a man and his friends searching for answers to the question why. What's revealed as they search is arrogance and pride, and an ignorance of God, the scriptures, and life. The friends were judgmental and pompous, and Job was self-pitying and self-righteous. At the end of 40-some chapters, God speaks. God actually speaks to Job. But he doesn't give one word about why. What does he say? First, he asks Job what right he had to question God. Who is Job in relationship to God? Then in Job 48, God tells him that what Job is doing in order to justify himself, in order to get answers to his suffering, he is discrediting God's justice and condemning God in order to justify himself. What does God mean by that? Well, Job had said that God was unfair, that he was vindictive, and that he was punishing him. All these things, which are totally wrong, because we saw in the first two chapters of Job what actually had taken place. Satan came before the Lord. The Lord asked him what he'd been doing. He said, I've been going to and fro upon the earth. And the Lord said, have you seen my servant Job? And Satan said, yes. And he said, then God said, you know, the things he said about him, what a good man he was. And Satan said, sure, you've put a hedge around him. You've given him all these things. Of course he is. And God said, okay, you can do everything but take his life, etc., etc. I believe God allowed us to see that conversation and then the rest of the book of Job in order to teach us that we don't begin to know why he's doing what he's doing. Can you imagine God having a conversation with Satan before something has happened to you? I don't think we ever even consider that that might have been a possibility. And when we try to figure out why God is doing what he's doing, so often we sin. We misjudge God. Even in allowing all of us to know what had taken place in heaven between himself and Satan, God still doesn't tell us why he did it. He brought Job into the conversation. He initiated the whole thing. And he doesn't tell us why. The problem with Job and his friends and with us is that we don't begin to know the mind of God and what he's doing. And when we begin to say that we do or demand to know, it often leads us into sin. Elihu told Job, "Beware of turning to evil, which you seem to prefer to affliction." That's Job 36:21. The evil was of pride in demanding to know that God account to him for his action, questioning his motives that he didn't have his best at heart, questioning his wisdom that he didn't know what was best, questioning his love that he didn't do what was best, questioning his creatorship and sovereignty that he didn't have the right to do what he chose. Instead of answering Job's questions and letting Job state why this should not be what was happening to him, God very carefully explained who he was and what he had done and what he was able to do. He established his right as the powerful, sovereign, eternal creator of the world and his right to do what seemed best to him. And Job's response was, "Surely I spoke of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. My ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. Therefore I despise myself and repent in ashes." It's Job 43:5. Job really had not known God. He knew about God, he believed in God, he worshipped God, and he even obeyed him. But it took unbelievable suffering to really bring Job face to face with the living God, to really see God for who he was, and therefore to also see himself in light of who God is, who God was. Our aim in this life is so often to acquire good family, good friends, good possessions, good relationships, good health, etc. When it should be the best relationship with God, our aim should be God Himself. The Israelites were released from hundreds of years of bondage. God's very presence went with them as they went out into the desert. But after a few hardships, all they could think of was Egypt and the food they had had there. When God took them to the very edge of the promised land, after all the ways He had shown Himself strong in their behalf, what was their reaction to some very big men? Fear and questioning of God. Deuteronomy 8 is so rich in what God does during the hard times, how He took the Israelites into the desert for 40 years to show Himself strong on their behalf, to teach them that He was all they needed. He took them in the desert in order to strip them of their self-reliance and their reliance on evil Egypt. God provided them manna to eat, not to provide them food per se, but to provide for them Himself, to show them that He was all they needed, to show them that we don't have to understand how He is able to provide for us. They had never heard or seen of manna before. He's all we need because He and He alone knows what we need. Trusting God, relying on His strength, knowing that nothing can touch us that He doesn't allow, is cooperating with Him in the truest sense. Then God has the freedom to work. Even as Christians, I don't believe God overrules our will. When we found out that Rod's cancer had returned, I asked the Lord to make me strong. I asked the Lord not to make me strong, but to be strong on my behalf. I ask Him to be my strength. I didn't know what the following days would hold, but I knew that He was well able to be strong for me. I have never walked in such dependence upon God or been so aware of His presence as I was during this last year. I saw Isaiah 43:2 lived out, where He promises, "When you walk through the waters, I will be with you. When you pass through the fire," etc., etc. It's when, it's not if. All of us will go through hard things, but He promises to go through them with us. A third area of cooperating with the Lord, I believe, is accepting each day as His best for us. Psalm 118:24 says, "This is the day the Lord hath made. Let us be glad and rejoice in it." God allows those things into our lives that are for our best. So each day, no matter how hard or easy, is from Him. Allow Him to use it for eternal good. Draw close to Him in your joy or in your pain. Don't turn to evil instead of pain. Last year, I consciously practiced living just for today, and it was a huge effort in the beginning. It's generic to human life to plan, at least in American life, where we do have control to one extent or another over what we do. The inclination was to put things on hold until Rod came home from the hospital, then to put things on hold until he recovered from his surgery, then to wait until he was through with chemo, then to wait till he was through, until things could get back to normal life. My concept of normal life. Obviously, things never became what they'd been before. And last year could have been unbearable if God had not taught us to take each day as His best for us and as normal life for us then. This isn't a forced cheerfulness, a looking on the positive side, a Pollyanna attitude. This is looking a denial of what's really happening, but an acceptance that what is happening has been allowed by God and that He will use it for good. And when we can accept and joyfully embrace that truth, then I believe the hard times can become the handiwork of God in our lives. Then we can move from defeating God to cooperating with Him. I believe a third way to live in the hard times is to have a godly perspective of life. First is in our relationship with God. My prayers are now for God to allow anything into my life that will accomplish His purposes and in the lives of my children. Years ago, I was struck by the verse in Psalm 106:15 that says, "He gave them their requests, but sent leanness to their souls." That really scared me. Could God actually answer a prayer for something I wanted desperately, and yet it would bring about a spiritual leanness? I could ask for things that weren't best, even though they seemed to be. And I'm not talking about material things. I'm talking about release from pain, release from suffering, release from death or dying. So often we assume that physical pain, sickness, and death are things to pray against. That's what we automatically do. That's what we automatically pray when we hear that someone is going through something like that. Our nature says to escape, so that's what we pray. But we don't know if that's God's will. Jesus told us to pray according to God's will. But how can we if we don't know what it is? But we know a lot more than we think we do. The scriptures are full of what God's will is for us. What we pray for, what we can pray for, is growth of relationship to Him, that we could see Him, experience Him, and know Him more deeply. We know that it is according to, we know that that is according to His will. Our prayers need to be for God to use it for good. We can pray that our lives would be changed, irrevocably changed, for God to refine and purify our faith, for character to be produced in our lives. The scriptures are full of the good, unbelievable, life-changing, eternal good that can come from suffering. So we need to ask God to work in it and thereby release us from the fear of it instead of take it away. Another area to have a godly perspective is in the release of fear. Fear of it. Job 36:15 says, "But those who suffer, He delivers in their suffering. He speaks to them in their affliction." It doesn't say He takes them away from it, but He comes into it with them, and He delivers them from the fear of it, and He speaks to them in the middle of it. There is such freedom and release, peace and contentment, when you lose your fear of pain and suffering. Rod had always said, since the first time he had cancer, that he didn't fear dying, but he feared the pain involved in dying. A few months before he died, he said he just didn't know if he could handle the pain involved in dying. And I reminded him that he had just spent a year in pain every day, some days so bad that he sat up all night because he couldn't lay down. And God had given him the grace to endure it. God had delivered him in it, not from it. The biggest factor in being released from fear is seeing the good that can come from it. And the greatest good is the presence of God Himself. Elihu told Job that God speaks to him in it, and believe me, you hear Him because you listen so intently. After Rod had cancer the first time, I began to do an in-depth study on suffering. But the longer I studied, the more I realized that it was God I was getting to know instead of just the subject of suffering. I was discovering a loving God. Yes, by studying suffering, I saw God's love expressed to me more deeply than I had ever known before. And I saw, as Job, vast dimensions to God that made it possible for me to trust him with areas of my life that I never had before. And I also saw how we play at our relationship to God. We may all have the outward uniform in action and words, but like Job, when life gets very, very painful, God may show us that he and he alone has not been our ultimate goal. We may have substituted our lifestyle instead of relationship. We may have made our activities, even Bible study, quiet time, etc., a substitute, an end in themselves, instead of a search for an ever-deepening relationship with the Lord. A third area of having a godly perspective is in our expectations. As last year progressed and I began to see how different our life was becoming, I gradually began to give back to the Lord the things he'd given me through having Rod as a husband. We have no rights, but subconsciously we expect them. The Lord had given me a husband for 20 years, and through him, children and a family life together. When we marry, we immediately have expectations. So many expectations, and we're only really aware of them when they're not met. I didn't get married expecting to become a relatively young widow. I didn't get married expecting to take care of a sick husband. I didn't get married, etc., etc. And with not expecting came not wanting. I didn't want our life to change. It was going along too well. Marriage had not been easy for us, but we had worked through a lot of things over the years, endured a lot, and had become very good friends. We'd gotten to the point of real companionship, and we were looking forward to the following years of doing more together, ministering together, and growing together. What a poor time for a drastic change. But I must say, the suffering only increased the friendship, the companionship. It caused us to grow more in every area of our relationship. And then I had to gradually give these things back to the Lord. My right to a continuing future with Rod, my right to be held in the warm, strong, loving arms of my husband, my right to be under the protection of a godly husband, my rights to so many things. As each of these issues and areas came to the fore, and the Lord enabled me to give them back to him, each time the Lord gave me more of himself. And he gave me a peace and contentment that I would have never dreamed possible in the middle of all of that had I not lived through it myself. The Lord gave me Rod to love and to be loved by him. The scriptures say he's given us all things to richly enjoy. Even a husband and a family, he did not mean to take the place of him. The last area of having an eternal perspective is seeing things from his eternal point of view. In order to trust God, it helps us to have a feel for what he's about. Paul says it very clearly in 2 Corinthians 4, 16 through 18. Therefore, we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes on what is seen. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. If Paul can call all that he went through light and momentary, can we not also? It is light and momentary in light of what's being prepared for us. It's light and momentary in light of the length of eternity. And the thought that encourages me and excites me is, if what Paul went through and what we go through in this life is light in comparison to what is eternal, then we can't begin to comprehend it. It is indeed far beyond anything we could ask or imagine. Just think of it. Rod's cancer, his last year in pain, suffering, dying, Paul's beatings, floggings, shipwrecked, are light compared to what they achieve in our lives and in their lives and in light of eternity. Why did God create us? Isn't this whole life of hardness and suffering rather sadistic on his part since he brought us into it? When I left home, I was hit with the meaninglessness of life. Is it just to grow up, get married, raise children, die, struggle, struggle, struggle the whole time? No, God created us for relationship with him. That's why we were created to live in relationship with him. That's why Christ came to bring us back into relationship with him. That's why we are alive. We destroyed that relationship through self-will, through sin. And even when we turn back to God through Christ, the effects of sin, not the penalty, but the effects are still there, clouding and minimizing our relationship to him. So therefore, God has to lovingly strip away the hold that this life has on us. Not just for his pleasure, but because the deeper our relationship to him, the more complete we become. It's deep within our nature to need to know God, but it's buried deeply beneath the cares and the appeals of this life, this body, and this world. And we cling tenaciously to our dependence upon a healthy body, a happy life, and all that we think we need for life. God has to take drastic measures to begin to strip away the fog from our blinded eyes and heart. Nothing in this life has so changed my relationship to the Lord as Rod's cancer. Job said, my ears had heard, but now my eyes have seen. God revealed himself to Job in his suffering, but first he had to totally strip him of his dependence upon his position, his security, his relationships, and reveal his self-dependence and his self-righteousness. It's only when our hold on this world is shaken that we begin to see beyond into eternity. God is here and now, and he is eternity at the same time. My prayers are no longer, Lord, save me, heal Rod, get us out of this. But Lord, show us yourself. Grant us the privilege of knowing you more deeply. Bring anything into our lives that will accomplish your purposes. This is the day learning to live content, realistically, cooperating with God by trusting, submitting, having a godly perspective of life. He made us for a relationship with him. He will go through with us through the hard times. He will release us from the fear of trials. By his very presence and seeing each day as a gift from him are just a very few of the things that he taught us over the last few years. Thank you for letting me share.